This episode is presented by Irving Bottle and the Brooklyn Kitchen.
This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes,
it's great. All right, welcome back to another edition of the Main Course OG. That was Rocket 88, the first rock and roll song ever recorded. We were actually just in Sun Studios in Memphis, Tennessee, where we got to hear that song played, not live, but closer to where it was originated.
It was a recording. I actually took a video, and I forgot it. Wanted to ask if I could play that version on air. It's exactly the same, but it was exciting to hear them talk about
it. I think it's public access at that point. Yeah, it's the first rock and roll song.
I like that you thought you saw it live.
I know. There was a little cutout cardboard poster of
almost as old as the strippers in the promo before the show. How old?
40-year-olds. Been in the business for 40 years. I mean, I hope they started very young. That's my only thing.
Yeah, hopefully. 18.
So anyway, that, and by the way, that Sun Studio song was the first sound ever to air out of these two now historic shipping containers. No one thought it would amount to anything, this station, but no one thought that radio.
But has it really?
Not really. But has rock and roll taken off too? So anyway, we are in studio today with Libby Greeley.
Hi.
Emily Pearson.
Morning.
Brandon Hoy.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonah Miller.
Good morning.
The owner of, I'll let Libby pronounce it, the owner of Huertas and the author of a great new book. He's a great friend of the station. So it's an exciting week. We're going to go rapid fire. I'll throw it to Libby to tell us what's going on.
Yep, we were off on a farm tour last week, but we were happy to be back in studio and on air, although you were not as cute as the pigs we saw week running around. And we have a great show for you from Dairy Queen. To
Way to
CB.
Warm up the guests. You say you're uglier than a pig.
The little baby pig.
Old people.
I hope they're heritage pigs.
Yes. Of course. Of course. And especially, we're touching upon my favorite horoscopes. And then later in the show, we'll talk to Jonah Miller, as Patrick said.
From which restaurant?
Patrick, stop.
Where? Tuss.
Hurt us. We'll jump right in to the weekly based. So, DQ will help make miracles for hospitalized children during DQ's 13th annual Miracle Treat Day, when $1 or more from every Blizzard treat sold at participating locations will be donated to local Children's Miracle Network hospitals, which I love ice cream. I know you do too, Emily. CMN hospitals raise funds to help save and improve the lives of kids treated at 170 children's hospitals across the U.S. and Canada. So not everything about fast food is bad. What is your favorite fast food and why? Well, interesting topic for us.
Ironically, many of those kids might be in the hospital because they ate fast food, but no, that's not serious. But
Wendy's is the best.
Everybody says McDonald's French fries and In-N-Out burgers. Those are always the top two where everyone's just like, I'm going to say it, and that's what I believe in.
It's like, if you want fast food, aren't you like going for the nastiest? I like Jack in the Box. I feel like that's like really you're only going at like 3 a.m. You're not like making the decision in the middle of the day, I'm going to Jack in the Box. Making a decision like at, it's like White Castle. You've only made this decision after 6-7 drinks.
Mm-hmm. I think the right level of nasty is Popeyes.
Oh, really?
Fair enough.
Ahoy.
There was a Popeyes by my high school, and during lunch break, we had many different lunch breaks, big school, so sometimes you have lunch at like 9:45 in the morning. So like, we'd be at Popeyes when they open.
Oh, my God.
First chicken of the day. Excellent.
What? Chicken? That's it? Chicken sandwich?
not a sandwich, like a three-piece dark, and the biscuits, of course.
I'm going to go with Gray's Papaya Hot Dogs. I mean, it's not traditional fast food, but it's definitely a chain. Their hot dog shot up from 75 cents a piece to like 250, but they're still delicious.
I'm definitely a fast food snob. Like, I'll only really do fast food if it's an experience. Like, we were just on the road at doing this farm tour, and we stopped in Salina, Kansas for the Cozy Inn, which is basically like the, I don't know if it's the precursor or just the local version of White Castle. And I don't eat White Castle. It doesn't make me feel good. I don't want to have it. But this, because you were there and it was the thing to do, you get a sack of six, the little sliders. They do the onions, the pickle, the whole deal. And like, that's worth the experience. Otherwise, slice of pizza.
So have you never stayed up till 4 a.m?
Sure, but White Castle is not what I want. Always. But,
so what do you do? What do you do after, you know, heavy night of drinking and you're
always
hungry?
Always pizza.
And, by the way, we went to the Waffle House, and that dude working on the same farm tour, that dude working the grill, made breakfast, I guess, for 17 people in 10 minutes. He was going. And I love it because he was still a chef. He wasn't just pushing buttons. He was going there and doing it. It was super cool. The other thing I'll say was funny, the previous farm trip we took, we went to Taco Bell, and I had all these, like, you know, emotional desires to try these things I had seen on the commercials, but I was overwhelmed by their menu. I panicked. I was like Jam Brady when the television
went on.
You
didn't miss much. That stuff is disgusting.
Is it? I mean,
yeah, Dorito, Chalupa. No, come on, man.
You're getting excited.
I can see the appeal when you watch the commercial, but it is just does not translate well.
At Grace Papaya, have you had the sausage, egg, and cheese for breakfast?
No.
That's a sleeper pick. Really? There's a warming drawer under the hot dog griddle.
I never get to Manhattan by noon, you know, before noon. I live in Brooklyn. I do everything in Brooklyn. Well, anyway, so yeah, not all fast food is bad. And I will say even McDonald's, which Soul Food opened against McDonald's, they still do a lot of good work and stuff. It's impossible to hate them. I do go to McDonald's like once every 3 months just because I'm like genetically engineered to want it, you know.
And the number of chefs that are trying to recreate the McDonald's french fry, mm-hmm. you know, but in a maybe healthier version.
Or hamburger. They make special sauce hamburgers, you know.
Interesting. Well, it's August 2nd now, and August is National Delicatessen Month. Deli means so many things. Jewish deli, we know that. That's you, Patrick. Corner deli, a deli in Montreal, a deli on Broadway. What does deli mean to you?
So what's my deli?
What? I have to read your aura.
Oh, please. Read my aura now.
That's a little anti-Semitic. Why? Because I'm Jewish? I only frequent Jewish delis?
You love Jewish delis.
All right, what's
I mean,
deli
it is really well, true. You do love you Jewish love delis. Jewish it's delis. Like, don't be a denier.
I know.
I don't want to speak for you, Patrick, but as a fellow non-observant Jew who grew up in New York, Jewish deli, Jewish cuisine is the main way I identify with the religion.
Yes, exactly.
And New York's the best place to have it.
It is. And I, you know, corned beef and pastrami are basically, like everything else in the world, commodity, but there's something value added about it, like Second Avenue Deli's taste. There's a little bit of something different. You know, corned beef and pastrami, Reuben's, those are super cool. But deli can also be the place around the corner, the Natch.
I was going to say, I think I too, Jewish New Yorker, and I do love corned beef pastrami, the whole thing. But these days, I think for me, deli is more like consistency, and that means consistently bad, consistently good. It's more like the bodega on the corner where you're gonna get your okay coffee, you're gonna get a good lunch sandwich because it's. But I mean, it's not gonna be high quality turkey and cheese.
I think deli's a cut above bodega.
Is it?
Yes. My parlance. I agree.
Yeah, bodegas.
So what's on the corner? Brooklyn Natural,
what
is that?
Can it still be an all Boar's Head deli?
Yeah, if they're sort of like in the East Village where this is, we have Sonny's and Annie's, which is like a bodega, but they have a sort of a deli program, if you will, where you can get exciting sandwiches.
Yeah, like Farmer, what is that? Farmer and the Deli, right? And
no, you just made that up. What the hell?
No,
sounds local.
On DeKalb, like a deli. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I don't go that direction.
Favorite children's song, The Farmer and the Deli?
Farmer and the Deli. You guys know it.
What are delis dying out, the traditional Second Avenue stars? I mean, Katz's. It always seems like they're on the brink of going out of business.
Dying out or dead, because how many are left?
Yeah, not very many.
And who wants to pay $24 for a corned beef sandwich?
A commodity corned beef sandwich.
They're delicious.
Wow, well, so you will spend money for something.
Oh! Oh. Wow. Okay. Next question.
Okay, on that note, we'll move along. So I'm actually excited. I used to live in Chicago, and Chicago's South Loop is getting a whole lot cheesier when the U.S. Pizza Museum opens its doors at Roosevelt Collection. Starting with a grand opening celebration on Friday, August 10th, I'm sad to be missing this, the Free Museum offers more than selfie moments, inviting visitors to explore the evolution of pizza culture through vintage artifacts and interactive programming. The Pizza Museum features menus, rare pizza boxes, vinyl records, vintage ads, toys, video games, and more. There's souvenirs, including clothing and original works by independent artists, all available for purchase. This is very interesting. How do you feel about
this? There's nothing more interactive than eating pizza.
That's true. It is an experience.
You're like, just give me the pizza. I don't know. If I went to a pizza museum, all I'd want to do is eat pizza.
Very hard.
I hope that they have plenty of pizza to eat, because it would drive me nuts to go look at all this stuff and not be able to eat pizza at the same time.
And who would they trust to make the pizza at a museum that encompasses all pizza?
I mean, you think in Chicago, right, you're going to go after, you know, you're going to go after the big names of Deep Dish,
deep
right?
Dish.
Which would be what's your favorite?
I'm blanking right
Pizzeria
now.
Pizzeria Uno.
Everyone loves Pizzeria Uno.
Who is it? Yeah, I'm blanking right now. I used to have friends come and visit, and I'd be like, we can get Deep Dish. You need to then nap for 3 hours. Like, we cannot have another activity right after that.
Too much oil.
So much cheese.
I think napping after a meal should just be commonplace.
Yes,
in general. I think you'll enjoy your meal better if you know immediately following there is a nap.
I try to average 14 hours of sleep a day, and sometimes I do need naps to achieve that goal.
Occasionally I walk into the office and Patrick's asleep on his couch.
Very occasionally.
Well, I find that people
it's a really small couch, too. I've seen it, too. He's like curled up like a little dog.
When you have a couch in your office, hurts. It's a good sign, a good indicator that you might like to nap. When Libby said that when her friends came to Chicago and she asked if they want Deep Dish, I thought you would say that they said no. Who likes Deep Dish?
Oh, well, if you're in Chicago, you have to do it. Yeah. Everyone's like there.
I guess I've done that once, and that's enough. I mean, Chicago's a weird place for this museum to be.
That's true.
Although
there's another one coming to New York, but it's not the same museum. And this one is not free. The one coming to New York is coming in October. It's like a one-week pop-up. I actually Googled this because I thought it was the same one. And they're charging like $35 or something like that. But
well, there must be a pizza pie at the end
there
of the
is
tunnel.
Going to be food. There is food included.
Well, in Chicago, they have... I was just in Rome, and there's Bonci Pizzeria, which is terrific. Ooh. And they just opened in Chicago, which was a strange but also probably very savvy decision not to... enter the New York flooded pizza market and said, be the best pizza in Chicago, probably by
wait, is there
miles.
A flooded pizza market in New York? News to me.
Seemingly.
Are we going to break this news here? Dave.
I will say that Roberta's is in many ways what you just read. It's a big place where you can spend a lot of time. You can go to different rooms. It has a lot of art, t-shirts,
breaking
and stuff.
Breaking news.
Too much pizza
in New
York.
Right. Take it away.
Time. Do you know what the best thing about David as engineer is?
What? Everything.
Timing.
Waka waka.
All right. Well, no, but this is a museum of sorts. Have you ever thought of like putting picture? Well, you do. You have all the old pictures. This, in a way, qualifies as a museum in a lot of ways. Because of all the old photos.
But this is just a museum of us. It's not. There's no like...
It's like a time capsule for the future.
It's a time capsule of us, though. There's no documentation of pizza as a thing. This is a time capsule of like what Roberta's, what the neighborhood, what the people who have come in and out of this place represents.
There's
to
not
us.
Enough pictures of me, by the way. I've noticed. I would like
there's
maybe
almost
a
none.
Portrait. A portrait.
You don't photograph well.
Oh, I know. I'm not.
It doesn't really translate. I'm not like, oh, that's a great photo of Patrick. But when I see you in person, I'm like, look at this guy. He's
sexy.
He's the real deal.
I know.
Clooney-ish.
Well, there's sex appeal. You can't convey that in the photo.
Yep, that's all right. A lot.
Next.
All right. So we got this press release about a new book by nature writer Susan Han Shetterly, Seaweed Chronicles, A World at the Water's Edge, being released by Algonquin Books on August 7th. You may not realize it, but it's almost impossible to go through a day without encountering seaweed, whether it's on your favorite sushi roll, hiding in your cosmetics, or incorporated into your vitamin supplement.
Or in the feed of your animals.
The feed of your pigs, yep. But beyond that, seaweed is utterly essential to our world. It produces much of the oxygen we breathe, forms the basis of all marine life, and serves as a linchpin for coastal communities across the globe. So what is your interaction for seaweed? This is a lot more than I thought. I thought a lot about seaweed after reading this.
Seaweed's everywhere. I mean, do you serve seaweed in a Spanish restaurant, chef?
We don't, although actually a purveyor with Spanish products came to us recently with Spanish seaweed. So we've made, you know, messed around with some Spanish kombu type of things, but you don't see much seaweed in traditional
non-Japanese
Spanish cooking.
Okay.
I mean, they do have seaweed there, and I guess they cook with it, but no, not often.
This wave sound is legit.
Yeah, I'm like, all of a sudden was very calm, also, and I didn't realize what it was from.
It's also amazing that you could say Algonquin with such ease, but you can't say Puertas.
Puertas.
Did I say it wrong?
Puertas.
We're just going to rename your restaurant, Jonah, if you don't mind. No.
But anyway, you remember what happened in Japan? There was the nuclear something or other. I mean, that exploded in, I think, the north.
Something or other.
No, there was a nuclear explosion at a plant.
Fukushima.
A power plant, Fukushima. Doesn't that affect the water supply? Doesn't that affect the seaweed? It's just funny. It's like, shouldn't that be listed as a thing? My friend Mark Ladner actually stopped serving West Coast fish at Del Posto because he thought it was just too dirty and stuff like that. So I just wonder, like, one day, don't you need to label that your cosmetics have seaweed in it, especially if it was sourced, like, at the site of a nuclear this or that?
Interesting.
Yeah, you would assume so, unless it gives you some sort of superhuman powers, which you should probably also then unveil.
It turns
that
you green.
Well, or, like, super cool.
Super cool. Maybe I'll photograph better.
Are you going to get this book and read it? And tell us about it, Petri?
Nah, I like it. They say, would you have this person on? I'm like, no, but we will copy-paste a paragraph from your request. No, but we mentioned the book, and you should see it, and seaweed is everywhere. I mean, it's now, to be honest, being fed to our pigs. Mm-hmm. It's 1% of their supply of feed.
And what is this company that you talk about as we?
It's pronounced weed.
Oh.
But it's... My father-in-law is involved with some company, and he was like, can we feed seaweed? And apparently it makes the pig shinier, and it helps their digestive system. It lines their gut in a way that allows them to be healthier, I guess. Everyone's talking about the gut these days.
When I was young, we used to go to Maine every summer, and we'd kayak. And I was always a little scared by the seals would come too close to the kayak. And then my dad, I don't know where he came across this, but an old Eskimo recipe for preparing seaweed. You gut a seal. And then you just eat what they had eaten.
Oh,
really?
My gosh.
And so how was it?
I was squeamish to, like, crack the sea urchins open at that stage. So we weren't gutting any seals.
Speaking of Eskimos, does anyone still live in igloos ever in the whole world? Is there one person living
There's
in an igloo?
There's probably an igloo with a very expensive bar. You read about that every few years.
Oh, not in Sweden. Not
or like Airbnb. Someone was doing that in their backyard when it snowed a lot in Boston. I remember that. But legitimately living in.
Because I think when I was born in like the 70s, people were still living in igloos. There were still a few people, you know. But anyway, times change.
Yeah, maybe for next week. Follow up on that. This
Thank
is
you.
A very exciting.
It's going to get better. Take that oxygen sound off the air.
We're deviating. Okay.
This is an exciting
in
segment.
In honor of Libby's love for astrology, which we heard about all on the farm trip. She read every chef their horoscope while in transit in the
car.
Well,
chefs are known to be big on their signs.
A lot of people knew already.
Is that true?
No.
Oh, well.
Well, anyone that got to be in her car, we were three vans, we caravaned, and she read everyone their sign and really worked through their life pivots and changes and what was coming up with what was
the
blood
group
moon.
Therapist. Oh, yeah, we had the blood moon while we were on the trip. Yep.
Did you also read the pigs their signs?
She might have.
They were
she
so
liked,
cute.
She liked those little piglets.
Don't let the portas hit you on the ass when you're walking out.
Okay. Yeah, on that note. So I was looking for some fun topics for this week, and I came across a Vine pair, and they have August 2018, your drink horoscope. So word on the street is that, Jonah, you are a Pisces. Is that correct?
That's so what's true. His drink?
Your drink, I don't know how to pronounce. It is a
Sounds
Schwartz
like my restaurant.
Beer. Sounds like a Jewish beer.
A Schwartz.
Schwartz beer. Opposite rule. Opposites rule your sign this month, paradoxical Pisces. Relationships with loved ones can blossom, but it may come at the expense of career ambitions. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to choose between work and play. Embrace duality by shaking things up in unexpected ways.
Nice term.
You'll have best results around the partial solar eclipse on the 11th. So that's a great time to try a delightfully surprising Schwarzbier. Its dark color disguises its light crispness, which is exactly the type of inspiration you should go for in the month of August.
Yeah. Great. Well, where can I find a Schwarzbier?
On the 11th or 12th.
I'll get back to you. Maybe you can bring it in through your...
Look in your Schwartz. Yeah. No, wait. Is it, who, did you give credit to who this is?
It's from a website called Vine Pear.
Okay.
Yes, of course.
Wait, so Pisces are the fish. Very emotional. Like, you might find yourself weeping a lot. One might say.
You nailed it.
So, happy almost birthday in September. Patrick, am I correct that you are a Aquarius?
Yep.
So, August is smoldering, and so are you. Oh. Your career planet, Pluto.
I do run hot.
It's warm today. But yeah. Your career planet, Pluto, is moving ahead, and with it comes a whirlwind of professional opportunities.
Pluto is not a planet anymore.
Mm. Oh, yes, sadly.
Vinepair must have missed it. Don't hesitate to take things to the next level. A moment of indecision could cost you dearly. If you need a little liquid courage when it's crunch time, it's advisable to go all in. A smooth smoked scotch is the drink of debonairs and dukes, the perfect confidence booster when you'll need it most.
I get Schwarzbier and he has a scotch?
Yes, smoked scotch.
He oftentimes smells like old leather and scotch.
It comes
mostly
from not
as morning fume.
Well, he wears that Reggie Jackson Yankee shirt most days, so.
Comes from not using deodorant.
Patrick, this is your song.
This is a great song. Hair was my favorite musical of all time, along with Moana and Beauty and the Beast.
All right. Libby and I are both Libras.
Thank God, because this segment's running long. No, just kidding.
And I don't have music for Libra, so.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, shoot. August is hot, 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 and you run the risk of burning up, fiery Libra. It's time to channel some of that emotion toward creative endeavors. Find cues in the cosmos for what you should attempt and what you should avoid. Wherever you find yourself, once Mercury is at greatest western elongation on the 26th, it promises to be the best time to gaze at the red planet as it shines brightly in the sky at sunrise. Toast to its radiance with a fitting tequila sunrise. Its orange hue may serve to alight new possibilities.
When's the last time you saw a tequila sunrise, honestly? Does that still
exist? Do you have one here at the Tiki Bar?
Yeah, of course not.
At Weirdos, we're doing a riff on the tequila sunrise right now with the Paloma mix. It's excellent. It's on our classic cocktail section.
All right, I'll be there tonight.
There we go.
Tequila
see?
Sunrise.
When I don't
mean,
have
you should tell your wait staff to really, you know, this target that towards Libras. Be like, any Libras here, you need this.
When I don't have a sex on the beach, I have a tequila sunrise.
Yeah? Your A-frame outside of Huertas should promote that to Libras. All right, and last but not least, the Virgo in the room, Brandon Hoy. Planetary obstacles are finally clearing themselves from your path.
Thank God.
Oh, you persistent Virgo. Setting you up for major movement this month. From work and family to health and wealth, you're on the cusp of a fortuitous shift that can help shape the final months this year in your favor. That means it's time to party. Send the summer out with a bang, and don't skimp on the champagne. So yours is a Blanc de Blanc champagne.
Oh, nice. Curing this nagging back pain, I'm assuming. They included my health, so I'm hoping.
Yeah, no, things are clearing up for you.
Clearing up for me.
You're feeling more regular? What's
not
David?
Really. Not really.
David
still
is
backed
also,
up.
I'm also a Virgo. Blanc de Blanc champagne, my friend.
Hey.
Pop bottles.
Popping bots.
Now, what happened? Didn't Jay-Z get into a tiff with the champagne company because they said something racist?
I thought
racist?
You were going to say with Beyonce.
No.
I'm going to the concert tonight. I'll have a word with him.
Are you?
Yeah.
Wow, where? MSG?
MetLife.
Oh, my God. Good luck.
Yeah,
better leave
my
now.
My roommate's coming tomorrow.
All right. Well, very, very cool.
How fun. All right. So
whiskey.
Moving from that. I love that. Now we all know what to drink. Thank you, Emily.
Oh, you're most welcome.
And so now. So Whole Foods recently was purchased by Amazon. We all know that. Nyman Ranch recently was purchased by Purdue. What do you think? Can a good company keep its soul when it gets bought out?
Ann actually told me that, a ton of cheese companies are being bought out by big companies, too. That's just happening, like, everywhere in Wisconsin. There's very few little guys left. It's funny. I would say my answer to this is that the company Purdue might not change Nyman, but the fact that Nyman sold is probably the sign that things are changing there. Purdue might be like, try to keep everything so it's not so much of a headache for us. But if you're selling your company, either because you're old or it's not making enough money, that's the sign that something is slipping. So I wouldn't necessarily accuse Purdue. I want nothing to do with them, but I wouldn't say you're going to ruin this company or Bezos, you're going to. But by selling out, Whole Foods probably gave something up.
What about when chefs work with like larger restaurateurs or groups? I don't know. Like, I feel like less so in the New York market, but in Chicago, there's like people who are, I don't know, Stephanie Izzard, all these people who join groups. Are they less, do they have less of their own soul? Well, I guess I'm looking at you.
I suppose as the person who runs a soul restaurant, I should say that they have sold out. But it's a difficult trade, and if you have the support system of a restaurant, I mean, you just do not have to worry about onboarding and HR and social media. It can be tempting. I understand it. I mean, you can focus on cooking, which is what, you know, ultimately you might want to do. So
it's hard to be a chef owner. I mean, you know, I think Brandon could speak to that too. When you're independent and everything is just within your own doors, there isn't the like corporate management. But I don't know. I don't think that's a good thing either.
But I outsource as well. You know, I agree. I think there's some of these lofty things like HR and accounting and certain and social media and certain things that like maybe somebody else can do better. And I think sometimes, you know, a little bit of support could actually add soul if it's helping you focus on the things that are most important to your restaurant and to you, which are, you know, the food, the service, or whatever it may be. It may be a helpful tool for you to actually, you know, interject more soul into what you do. I don't know. I think it's a great question. It's a great topic. I'm sure this is one of those things that could really kind of go either way depending on how you're using it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I was in LA recently. I went to Kismet, and Sarah they were the chefs at Glasserie, which is, you know, a small independent restaurant in Greenpoint. And I was a little on the fence about going to Kismet. I'd been to Glasserie, I'd had some of their food before, and I liked it, but I thought I should try something new. At any rate, Kismet was, I thought, head and heels better than Glasserie. It was just a better experience. The food was even better. And maybe because they're part of a restaurant group there and they have the support around them, they can really focus on, you know, running that one restaurant and not everything around it. And it was a really terrific meal.
Yeah, you could get bogged down in kind of the back office stuff. It could really, as a restaurateur or operator, if you're a chef operator, you have a lot of things on your plate. You could start getting bogged down in things that that don't necessarily translate to the customer experience, and that could actually, you know, negatively affect what the customer sees, because your head is in a different space and you're spending more time trying to, like you said, onboard people, or, you know, make sure that you're like following the many, many rules that there are out there to running a restaurant. It could be difficult.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a last side to
it. So are you going to stop supporting Niman Ranch now that they are bought by Purdue, Libby?
I only support Heritage, you know that.
Okay.
okay, so you're all in food. And we were just talking about some publications that closed this morning.
Teen Vogue.
Teen Vogue is
very
out.
Very sad.
Bride.
Bride.
You should have gotten married earlier, Libby, because now you're going to have to do it without any
good
magazine.
Good thing I collected. Good thing I saved all of my past
issues
of Bride.
Oh, good, good.
Please share them with me.
All of your past brides.
Not that past I'm brides. Engaged, right?
I did not collect my past brides, sorry.
All right, question. I know you know the answer. What Ruth Reichel editor magazine closed by Condé Nast about 10 years ago? Gourmet magazine.
You didn't even give them a chance to answer.
Well, no, I saw Jonah knew it. Everyone. That's
right,
an easy question.
It.
But yeah, so wow. Three magazines closed.
What was the third
and
one?
They're moving out of they're moving out of the World Trade Center.
They can't afford their rent with that move.
I think certain floors of the World Trade
Center. Certain floors. Well, the New Yorker is moving. And I forget, they have one other big magazine that was in that article, but yeah. So Anna Wintour. She's safe.
Vogue.
She's safe.
Of course.
Have no fear. There's budget for her. You know, black sunglasses, car and driver.
She's done pretty well, man. Anna Wintour, they made a movie about her, played by Meryl Streep.
But what food publications do you read? What sources do you trust?
Brandon, you don't read
HRN.
Any food public.
I don't. I often do not read food publications.
Do you read?
I mean.
You read sports, right?
Well, no, I actually can't read. I'm illiterate.
You're overcoming a lot.
The sports section is very meditative.
Yeah. I actually listen to sports on an audio tape.
Okay.
Usually I get all of my sports weeks later.
You're like Reggie Jackson retired?
It's difficult.
You're like, Patrick, congratulations. Yeah. Andy Pettit just pitched a two-hitter.
I heard some subliminal messaging. Did anyone else hear that? I think I have HRN, like that, Heritage Radio Network. There must have been something coming through my head.
Oh, is that what it is? That's where I get all of my news.
Well, anyway, the New York Times food section, I mean, I have great respect for these people. I mean, that section is a is ridiculous. I mean, they don't have a serious article in there almost ever. Marion Burroughs used to write serious articles. Kim Severson occasionally writes serious articles. If you were to mention the top 10 issues of our time, top 10 issues in the world in our time as it relates to food, none of those 10 are ever covered by them. Global warming, famine, drought, you know, seed prices, commodity pricing, animal abuse, humane. It's just not covered. And I know what they say. We're not, that's not us. That's for the business section. And times have changed. We need a new generation of people. Also, Bon Appetit, Food and Wine. I mean, I respect these people. They're much smarter than me. They know more people than me and all that. But I want to kind of go and read some serious topics in those food sections.
I have found myself at the beach a few times lately, which is not my favorite place. And I have to pack a tent for my kid and a lot of other stuff. So I don't pack publications, but I, you know, look online. Anyway, one that I recommend and is good for beach reads is Roads and Kingdoms.
Oh.
They have some good...
What is that?
It is a food travel... so a lot of food pieces about, you know, places around the world. I was just looking at how to have like a 20-hour Basque brunch, which was right up my alley. The lead editor, Matt Golding, is a writer. He wrote for Spanish food, I think it's called Pig Olive Grape, and then recently released the Italian version, Pasta Pane Vino. They're really good books.
And, okay.
They were on Anthony Bourdain was label.
But, I think Civil Eats. Lisa Held, a journalist, and our friend was here, and they have...
Host of the Farm Report now.
Yes, yes. So she's doing great things, and they have great articles up more up the alley of what you were talking about. But always, why don't you like the beach? Is it the sand? I'm always interested.
It's very hot, the sand.
The sand. People hate the sand.
It's boring.
Another new reason to dislike the beach is all the sharks around here recently. No.
Was also just Shark Week.
That's true.
Doesn't help.
In defense of the times, though, I mean, I loved Frank Bruni.
Frank Bruni.
There was an era where... It was, you know, fun. It was.
I love Florence
Fabricant.
I mean, that's news.
As well.
And also, who gave you your 7-star review?
Yeah.
Was that guy Sam Sifton? Was it?
Sam Sifton.
He literally gave them a 7-star review. It was unprecedented. He said it was the best 3-star restaurant, the best 2-star restaurant.
Peter Meehan. I mean, it's, you know, in defense of it, it's had its moments. But I hear you.
I think
at a certain point you don't want to politicize everything.
No.
Like sometimes like sports, you just want sports, and like food, sometimes you just want food. You don't
no, but
it doesn't need to be
food
political.
Now. That's food now, you know, and I think
well, that's sports now too, but also like you, there has to be some differential. There has to be publications that are based in the politics of food, and there has to be publications that are based in the enjoyment of food.
I don't know, also in defense of the times, it used to be called dining in, dining out.
Yeah.
I don't think it was this we're going to tackle the whole world of food and all the politics that come with it. Correct me if I'm maybe the yeah. Where were those articles that you loved published? In
no.
The food section, or were they business? Were they science?
Oh, I love Marion Burroughs. I just say occasionally they need to say, like, we give a column to Marion Nestle, or we give a column to Wendell Berry, or just something so that you
deep
can
deep dives
also,
like that are for HRN.
Deep dives?
Yeah,
HRN.
That's
well,
what
I
that's
love
what we're
HRN.
Here for.
Well, that's
you,
why
you know
we
that
started
place.
This station was because we felt a lot of those topics were getting short shift in the media, or they would say, we covered that issue 12 years ago. And
yeah.
You're like, well, it's time to revisit it. I just think food is changing. What about food deserts? Can't that be an article once every 6 months? You know, and I don't know that it is in that station. I think they need a refresher for who works there. And I don't just say the Times, because, I mean, it's the most important publication of all time, but I don't know.
I don't know. It's also this moment where, you know, the food news that is on everybody's forefront of their mind is what restaurants are opening, what's closing, what are the new trends, what's going on in fast food, you know.
New
what's,
trends.
But I'm just saying that tends to be, correct me not if I'm wrong, Grub Street, Eater, that's what they're covering. I mean, there's constantly new articles posted every 10 minutes, but none of them are about substance, as you're saying.
We've covered about 400 stories on this show, even though we've only done 10 episodes. None came from the Times. They all come from other sources. And that's just interesting that here we are looking to the Times food section to give us something.
Speaking of new trends, have you guys heard of fusion?
Oh, really?
Yes.
What is happening that?
They're taking like Asian cuisine and mixing it with, you know, kind of modern American stuff. This is... an anomaly.
David, don't say you don't learn stuff on this station.
We have succotash on our menu right now, and I warned our staff not to use the word medley. And then we're trying to find other words that are just words you shouldn't ever use at the table because they've lost all. So fusion was the next example of a word. Never want to hear anyone talk about fusion here.
Okay. We need to go to a quick break. But after, we talk to Jonah Miller about and get his insight into the world of Spanish cuisine, his newly published book, and we can find out if anyone here can actually pronounce his restaurant name correctly.
Is that the Maillard question?
No, take it away, David. We'll cease to exist if I come into a party hitting reps like this. All you superficial rappers will cease to exist if I come into a party hitting reps like this. All you superficial rappers will cease to exist if I come into a party hitting reps like this. All you superficial rappers will cease to exist if I come into a party hitting reps like this. All you superficial
This episode is presented by Irving Bottle, an approachable and affordable wine and liquor shop in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Irving Bottle focuses on natural wines and high-quality spirits that are delicious, unconventional, and a good value. Ask about their weekly Wednesday tastings, 10% case discounts, in-store pickup, and free local delivery. Visit them online at irvingbottle.com. This episode is also presented by the Brooklyn Kitchen, a recreational cooking school on a mission to change the world by teaching people how to cook like grown-ups. With two locations in Williamsburg and Sunset Park's Industry City, the Brooklyn Kitchen hosts a range of public and private cooking classes, corporate team parties, pop-up dinners, tasting events, and local rentals for film and video shoots. Learn more at thebrooklynkitchen.com.
All right, so we are here live on the Heritage Radio Network in Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to the Main Course OG. So we are going into the Maillard reaction, our favorite part of the show where I make up the question. All right, so we went down south for our farm tour and dove into the world of barbecue and biscuits. What is your favorite southern food? I gained about 10 pounds from this trip, but...
Doesn't show.
So good.
I'm a bit. So I love biscuits.
Me too.
I really do. Biscuit, even biscuits and gravy. Are you kidding me? I'm a sucker for that stuff. Gravy in general. Fried chicken.
Yeah, collard
fried
greens.
Chicken counts. I've already drawn my flag with Popeyes.
I'm confused why biscuits didn't make it up north. They're so good. I'm like, we could eat this every day, but
they don't have enough inside. I guess they do have inside. There's something about the biscuit that I don't like. They're not absorbent. Yeah. I don't.
You have to
know
like
it
build
is.
It yourself. You have to put your own stuff on. One morning we had bacon and tomatoes on biscuits.
Is bacon a southern food?
I think bacon's everywhere. It's
so
global.
Then I say collard greens then.
With the bacon on it.
Yes, it has
to have the beans or the bacon in it.
And cream of corn, mac and cheese. I don't know. Are those southern?
The sweet cream corn.
Yes.
That was very good.
Grits.
Yeah, grits are good.
Meh. Grits are okay. Do you remember My Cousin Vinny, best grit scene of all time? So you're saying that your grit cooks faster in your kitchen than anywhere else in the world?
Anyway. Strong scene.
Well, that was a great Maillard question.
Thank you. Now I feel like you didn't love it.
Now I'm on a vegetable-only diet this week.
Yeah, we're
are
detoxing.
You? Except
no.
when you went to
no,
Sambar
except when
and
I went
had
to
like
Sambar.
An eight-course meal.
Exactly.
Well, Max from Sambar came on the trip with us and was so endeared by David Newman that he invited David, who was in town again, to a big extravagant dinner, which I couldn't make because it was Josie's birthday. Anyway, let's move on to
there
bigger
There was
things.
No lack of meat, I will tell you that.
Yeah, no, it was a great time. Okay, so Jonah Miller is a chef and owner of Hortas, which focuses on Spanish cuisine in the East Village. We are big fans and happy to have him here. So what's the biggest thing people don't know about Spanish cuisine?
Well, I think something that we struggle with is making sure people identify what we're cooking as Spanish. And Spanish cuisine is a lot like Italian cuisine or French cuisine. And so I think the biggest thing they don't know is, you know, it's not necessarily unfamiliar. That it doesn't have to be, you know. One issue with Spanish cuisine is it's very finite dishes that people recognize. So things like tortilla and paella, of course, and sangria. So they don't know that there's just a whole lot more than that. It's if, you know, Italian cuisine, you only thought there was, you know, carbonara and amatriciana and nothing after that. So there's so much that they don't know. I think, you know, the wine, the beverage culture of Spain is certainly something that we really embrace and people don't know that much about. Nate, who's my partner at Weird Dust and the co-author of the book, we have a whole section of beverages And I like to brag that I really think we're the only restaurant in the world where on tap you can get not just beer, but also we have sherry on tap, we have cider on tap, we have vermouth on tap that we make in the basement, and also gin and tonic on tap. So there's a whole lot of you know, interesting things to drink besides sangria, which really serious people don't drink sangria.
Oh, I see. You're expanding the horizons with this.
So Basque, is that, do you venture there?
So the restaurant is, we identify as Basque, which to be honest is partially marketing because people sort of know that the Basque country is famous for great food. Although we do focus on the Basque. We have pinchos, which are a Basque form of tapas. The Basques are very mysterious. If you want a serious...
And they do not want to be considered Spanish.
They don't want to be considered Spanish. And the Basque country skirts the border over to France as well. But they're culturally very strange. Like even their blood type is a bit unusual. And the language is it's not part of the Indo-European language chain. So they're sort of like a mythical people. And they care deeply about the things that we like, sports and food. So we look at all of the north of Spain. The north is closer to the rest of Europe. It's also the climate, the geography is closer to what we have in New England. So it makes a lot more sense for us to be identifying with the north of Spain. I mean, the name of the restaurant, and I'll just say it myself, Huertas. I never realized it was such a hard thing to pronounce.
This damn H.
Libby was struggling. It comes from...
Is H a vowel or something?
We were all struggling.
Libby, you were identified as the person who was terrified to say the name of the restaurant going into the recording. Yes. But it means orchard. I lived on a street in Madrid called Calle de la Huertas, and it's an old street. Like most streets in Madrid, it's so old that the building next to where I lived when I was there is where Cervantes lived when he wrote Don Quixote. But it means orchard, and in the north of Spain, you're known to have huertas, so small sort of farms and orchards, kind of like the equivalent of the back 40 here, where it's not the Midwestern style of like giant agriculture, the same way you'd see in the south of Spain. It's little plots like you have in New England, and cider, apples, orchards are one of the main ties between New York and the north of Spain.
So when you travel to Spain, do you specifically go to the north? Like, what would be your ideal trip to Spain if you had a week or 10 days?
So when I lived in Spain, I was living in Madrid, and actually I traveled around a lot, as you do when you're living in Europe, and it's so easy to get around. But I didn't go to the Basque country because I sort of knew that was the place that I would enjoy the most. And if I didn't go while I was studying abroad, I would have to go back, which I did before we opened the restaurant. So if I were there for 10 days, I would do something sort of sacrilegious and skip Barcelona. Barcelona is obviously great food, beautiful on the beach, architecture is amazing, but it's also, to me, like a little bit less Spanish. There's so many people from all over the world there.
Interesting. Skip Barcelona. That's a big statement. That's cool.
And what would you be drinking? What would you be drinking on this?
Well, so I'd go
like to Sidra would be the...
I would go to Madrid and drink some vermouth. And then I would probably...
Just straight vermouth.
Straight vermouth.
Killing it.
Mixing sour with bitter, or I mean the sour and sweet?
Sweet. They have a vermouth culture, which is... it's not like too... It's a sweet style of vermouth, but it's not overbearingly sweet. And you see it on tap. And we do that at the restaurant. I recently, you know, we were talking about as a restaurateur, you have to do everything. I recently took over the chalkboard outside of the restaurant. Our resident chalkboard artist left, and so it was me. And I worked on my Boss font. They have a font. There's a Boss font. So I did a Boss font, and it says, "We make vermouth in the basement." And our vermouth sales have just got... Actually, I don't know if they've changed at all, but I think people like the sign. And we make vermouth, and it's on tap. And that's a thing that you see in Madrid. It's an old-school thing. The first time I was in Madrid, I was sort of terrified by this vermouth del Grifo. I never got it, but it's really tasty. Super refreshing. It's kind of what... You know, the answer to sangria is vermouth on the rocks with an olive and orange.
Is it strong? Like, do you get drunk really fast?
No.
Was it 10%, 8%?
It's more than that. I mean, it's fortified wine that they're usually starting with, or they're adding brandy. So it's something like 11, 12, 13. But that's a good, maybe a little more. It's a good thing to drink and get a little.
And blood. You failed us by not bringing some.
That's true. I didn't stop at the... I live in Brooklyn, so I didn't stop at the restaurant on my way. It's a good gift that I often bring. Next time I come to Roberto's, I'll bring some.
I will be here waiting.
But that is also just speaks to the culture of drinking in Spain, which is that you drink all day. So you have to find things that are like that happy medium where, you know, they're not beer and they're so heavy that they're going to fill you up, but they're also
subtherapeutic. Just like low doses throughout the day.
ABV, the Spanish for the, you know, the...
So tell us a little bit about your book, The New Spanish. You said it obviously talks about beverages and food.
El Nuevo Español.
It So it hits some of the, you know, the sections of the menu at Huertas that are things that you don't see in every Spanish restaurant in every town. So pinchos and also conservas. Conservas are something that are you know, you see, again, this sort of thing in other parts of Europe where there's serious fish in cans. But that's something that Americans are just starting to understand, that something in a can is not necessarily a bad thing. We were talking about the New York Times section and food section. It's still, you know, it's still the food section that matters the most. And when we were reviewed by the New York Times, it made a big difference in a way that nothing else did. But it always sticks with me. It was a great review. But one of our servers, who was not my favorite server, to be quite honest, was serving Pete Wells. And she said to him within earshot of me, because it's an open kitchen, about our conserva section, in Spain, all the best seafood goes into tins. Can we curse on this or no?
Yes. So fuck,
I was like,
shit.
I was like, what the fuck does that mean? All the best seafood goes in tins. That's the most ridiculous thing you could say. But they have so much good seafood that a lot of it ends up going in tins. But Pete Wells, of course, published that line in his article. But he liked it. So water under the bridge. But there's so much great seafood that they have this culture of tin seafood. Okay. And you'll go to a bar in Spain, they literally just hand you a can and toothpicks. And sometimes they'll also charge you 15 euro for that can because it's, you know, 40 amazing little cockles that have been squeezed into there elegantly. So there's a section on how to make your own conservas and also how to use tins in a, you know, kind of simple way. It's great for entertaining. Pinchos are a perfect way to throw a dinner party because you do all the work ahead of time. The same way they do in Spain, when you walk into a bar, it's just lined with pinchos and the bartender is now partying with you. I mean, they're able to pour drinks because they're not mixing elaborate cocktails, serve the pinchos, keep track of what you've had, talk about your day. So they're an entertainer in a way that's pretty, and host, like, unusual in the U.S. And that's why we wanted to have a Spanish restaurant in the first place. It's just the experience of dining in Spain is so damn fun. I mean, there's so little pretense to it. You don't even need to look at the menu half the time. You just point to what you want to have.
Your bars always fall right the second it opens. Sometimes I'll be making the delivery, and I'll see right at 5:15, something like that. It's packed.
Well, they 5:15, also have we're great still at, deals at the bar. They have a great happy hour.
5:15, we're still at our lineup, our staff meeting at the bar. Right, so the bar is always full at 5:15 because we're having our meeting.
So it's everyone when you pay.
5:30, we there's often a couple seats left. I don't want people to think they can't come in. But the bar does fill. We didn't have a liquor license for our first year. We had wine and beer, which in Spain, you know, wine and beer is, we also have to have sherry and cider and vermouth. So we had a great beverage program, but it also forced us to be creative. And I mean, it was very frustrating.
I don't remember those days, but does that include fortified wines? Because that would really,
yeah, that was
like all of those fortified wines would fall into the beer and wine.
Right. We did include fortified. I think when we added fortified wines, we weren't entirely sure, but thought like, let's give it a try. And I think anything under, there's like a rule obviously about this. I think it might be something under 20%.
Right.
It was difficult without a liquor license. We're happy to have one.
So listen, can I get some rapid fire music, please, David, if you don't mind? Okay. You have an under 2 minutes. I'm going to ask you 4 rapid fire questions.
Ready.
What do you do when hiring a cook? What do you look for?
I look for plastic wrap that's fucked up. If you have big plastic wrap rolls in restaurants, you know that sometimes they get sort of snagged. And I'll hand that one to the trail to have them wrap something. And if they, before they start wrapping it, realize that it's messed up and take the time to fix it, which can be very difficult. I can't teach that.
Would you take my resume away? I cannot work for you. I never do that. I wrap something with a little like dental floss.
I hate that. I can't teach you how to be a good person. I can teach you how to cook.
What's your favorite pincho?
If I had to eat one every day, and I do, it's the Gilda or Hilda. It's named after the Rita Hayworth film in the 1940s. It's anchovy, white anchovy, sometimes black, olive and pickle, and it's like an oyster. It hits the sides of your tongue, gets your appetite going.
How did you start cooking in restaurants?
My closest friend growing up is still a dear friend who's in restaurants. For his bar mitzvah, I got a gift card to eat at Chanterelle.
Hmm.
So the two of us, the two 13-year-old boys, sat down for dinner at one of the most elegant restaurants in the country at the time, and they were not dismayed, but they invited us back to the kitchen, and one thing led to another, and we worked there the following summers.
Did you start as a dishwasher, or you started as a line cook?
No, I'd like to say that I wish I could say that I started as a dishwasher. I didn't start as a line cook either. I started as a prep cook, and they were actually renowned for great family meals. His first cookbook was recipes from family meals, so I'd often help with that, cleaning squid and such. It was a memorable summer because I broke my arm playing basketball, so I had a cast, and I was cleaning squid for three weeks with a cast on my arm. And the doctor, when he saw the thing off, was horrified.
Oh, God. I'm
it's one thing when you're able to dunk, you get injuries like that.
Right, right.
Who's your favorite Yankee?
Well, we're both wearing Yankee shirts, and I'm wearing Rivera. Rivera is my favorite. You know, of course, when you went to a Yankee game in the 90s and 2000s, you wanted them to win, but you only wanted them to win by one or two or three
Mariano.
Runs, so you could see Rivera.
He messed up only a couple times historically, but that's the thing, the reliever, it's so stressful. I think he was the best of all time, although Brandon probably has some Dodger who thinks he was the best.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was a great show. We're sorry that I, you know, said the name of the restaurant so poorly. We
say
now
it
know.
One last time. You can
Porches.
Do it.
Porches. Better, okay, better. Yeah, yeah. But I love
H is still a little breathy.
Where Tess? Did I do it? Where Tess?
But I love what it means, Orchard. That's very nice. Your book is beautiful. Thank you so much for being on here.
Thanks for dedicating it to Heritage. Now we can take it back to our office. It is a beautiful book. Everyone should buy it. Who published it?
It's published by Kyle Books, who, while we were working with them, was bought by Octopus Publishing, British imprint.
Apropos. Okay.
The title of the book is The New Spanish, Bites, Feasts, and Drinks by Jonah Miller and Nate Adler.
Yes. So thank you for listening, and stay tuned for Tech Bites at 11 a.m.
Thank you.
All right. Good show.
Women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.